Finally, Yasna moved on to the sketchbook filled with drawings of plants and animals Shallan had observed during her trip. Yasna spent the longest on this, reading through each notation. "Why have you made these sketches?" Yasna asked at the end.
"Why, Brightness?"
"Well, because I wanted to." She grimaced. Should she have said something profound instead? Yasna nodded slowly. Then she rose. "I have rooms in the conclave granted to me by the king. Gather your things and go there. You look exhausted."
"Brightness?"
Shallan asked, rising, a thrill of excitement running through her. Yasna hesitated at the doorway. "At first meeting, I took you for a rural opportunist, seeking only to ride my name to greater wealth."
"You've changed your mind?"
"No," Yasna said. "There is undoubtedly some of that in you. But we are each many different people, and you can tell much about a person by what they carry with them. If that notebook is any indication, you pursue scholarship in your free time for its own sake. That is encouraging. It is, perhaps, the best argument you could make on your own behalf. If I cannot be rid of you, then I might as well make use of you. Go and sleep. Tomorrow we will begin early, and you will divide your time between your education and helping me with my studies." With that, Yasna withdrew. Shallan sat, bemused, blinking tired eyes. She got out a sheet of paper and wrote a quick prayer of thanks, which she'd burn later. Then she hurriedly gathered up her books and went looking for a servant to send to the Wind's Pleasure for her trunk. It had been a very, very long day, but she'd won. The first step had been completed. Now her real task began.
Nine. Damnation. 10 people, with sharp blades alight, standing before a wall of black and white and red. Collected, Yesachev, 1173, 12 seconds pre-death. Subject, one of our own Ardents, overheard during his last moments. Kaladin had not been assigned to Bridge 4 by chance. Out of all the bridge crews, Bridge 4 had the highest casualty rate. That was particularly notable considering that average bridge crews often lost one-third to one-half of their number on a single run. Kaladin sat outside, back to the barrack wall, a sprinkle of rain falling on him. It wasn't a high storm, just an ordinary spring rain. Soft, a timid cousin to the great storms. Syl sat on Kaladin's shoulder, or hovered on it, whatever. She didn't seem to have any weight. Kaladin sat slumped, chin against his chest, staring at a dip in the stone which was slowly collecting rainwater. He should have moved inside Bridge 4's barrack. It was cold and unfurnished, but it would keep off the rain. But he just couldn't care. How long had he been with Bridge 4 now? 2 weeks? 3? An eternity? Of the 25 men who had survived his first bridge deployment, 23 were now dead. 2 had been moved to other bridge crews because they'd done something to please Gaz, but they'd died there. Only one other man and Kaladin remained. 2 out of nearly 40. The bridge crew's numbers had been replenished with more unfortunates, and most of those had died too. They had been replaced. Many of those had died. Bridge leader after bridge leader had been chosen. It was supposed to be a favored position on a bridge crew, always getting to run in the best places. It didn't matter for Bridge 4. Some bridge runs weren't as bad. If the Alethi arrived before the Parshendi, no bridgeman died. And if they arrived too late, sometimes another high prince was already there. Sadeus wouldn't help in that case. He'd take his army and go back to camp. Even in a bad run, the Parshendi would often choose to focus their arrows on certain crews, trying to bring them down one at a time. Sometimes, dozens of bridgemen would fall, but not a single one from Bridge 4. That was rare. For some reason, Bridge 4 always seemed to get targeted. Kaladin didn't bother to learn the names of his companions. None of the bridgemen did. What was the point? Learn a man's name, and one of you would be dead before the week was out. Odds were you'd both be dead. Maybe he should learn names. Then he'd have someone to talk to in damnation. They could reminisce about how terrible Bridge 4 had been, and agree that eternal fires were much more pleasant. He smirked dully, still staring at the rock in front of him. Gaz would come for them soon, send them to work, scrubbing latrines, cleaning streets, mucking stables, gathering rocks. Something to keep their minds off their fate. He still didn't know why they fought on those blustering plateaus. Something about those large chrysalises. They had gemstones at their hearts, apparently. But what did that have to do with the Vengeance Pact? Another bridgeman, a youthful maiden with reddish blonde hair, lay nearby, staring up into the spitting sky. Rainwater pooled in the corners of his brown eyes, then ran down his face. He didn't blink. They couldn't run. The war camp might as well have been a prison. The bridgemen could go to the merchants and spend their meager earnings on cheap wine or whores, but they couldn't leave the war camp. The perimeter was secure. Partially, this was to keep out soldiers from the other camps. There was always rivalry where armies met. But mostly it was so bridgemen and slaves could not flee. Why? Why did this all have to be so horrible? None of it made sense. Why not let a few bridgemen run out in front of the bridges with shields to block arrows? He'd asked, and had been told that would slow them down too much. He'd asked again, and had been told he'd be strung up if he didn't shut his mouth. The Light Eyes acted as if this entire mess were some kind of grand game. If it was, the rules were hidden from bridgemen, just as pieces on a board had no inkling what the player's strategy might be.
"Kaladin?"
Syl asked, floating down and landing on his leg, holding the girlish form with the long dress flowing into mist.
"Kaladin? You haven't spoken in days."
He kept staring, slumped. There was a way out. Bridgemen could visit the chasm nearest the camp. There were rules forbidding it, but the sentries ignored them. It was seen as the one mercy that could be given the bridgemen. Bridgemen who took that path never returned.
"Kaladin?"
Syl said, voice soft, worried.
"My father used to say that there are two kinds of people in the world," Kaladin whispered, voice raspy. "He said there are those who take lives, and there are those who save lives."
Syl frowned, cocking her head. This kind of conversation confused her. She wasn't good with abstractions.
"I used to think he was wrong. I thought there was a third group. People who killed in order to save."
He shook his head.
"I was a fool. There is a third group. A big one. But it isn't what I thought."
"What group?"
she said, sitting down on his knee, brow scrunched up.
"The people who exist to be saved or to be killed. The group in the middle. The ones who can't do anything but die or be protected. The victims. That's all I am."
He looked up across the wet lumberyard. The carpenters had retreated, throwing tarps over untreated wood and bearing away tools that could rust. The bridgeman barracks ran around the west and north sides of the yard. Bridge 4's was set off a little from the others as if bad luck were a disease that could be caught. Contagious by proximity, as Kaladin's father would say.
We exist to be killed,
Kaladin said. He blinked, glancing at the other few members of Bridge Four sitting apathetically in the rain. If we're not dead already.
I hate seeing you like this,
Syl said, buzzing about Kaladin's head as his team of bridgemen dragged a log down into the lumberyard. The Parshendi often set fire to the outermost permanent bridges, so High Prince Sadeus's engineers and carpenters were always busy. The old Kaladin might have wondered why the armies didn't work harder to defend the bridges.
There's something wrong here, a voice inside him said. You're missing part of the puzzle. They waste resources and bridgemen lives. They don't seem to care about pushing inward and assaulting the Parshendi. They just fight pitched battles on plateaus, then come back to the camps and celebrate. Why? Why?
He ignored that voice. It belonged to the man he had been.
You used to be vibrant, Syl said. So many looked up to you, Kaladin. Your squad of soldiers, the enemies you fought, the other slaves, even some light eyes.
Lunch would come soon. Then he could sleep until their bridge leader kicked him awake for afternoon duty.
I used to watch you fight, Syl said. I can barely remember it. My memories of then are fuzzy, like looking at you through a rainstorm.
Wait, that was odd.
Syl hadn't started following him until after his fall from the army, and she'd acted just like a regular windspren back then. He hesitated, earning a curse and a lash on his back from a taskmaster's whip. He started pulling again. Bridgemen who were laggard in work were whipped, and bridgemen who were laggard on runs were executed. The army was very serious about that. Refused to charge the Parshendi, try to lag behind the other bridges, and you'd be beheaded. They reserved that fate for that specific crime, in fact. There were lots of ways to get punished as a bridgeman. You could earn extra work detail, get whipped, have your pay docked. If you did something really bad, they'd string you up for the Stormfather's judgment, leaving you tied to a post or a wall to face a high storm. But the only thing you could do to be executed directly was refuse to run at the Parshendi. The message was clear. Charging with your bridge might get you killed, but refusing to do so would get you killed. Kaladin and his crew lifted their log into a pile with others, then unhooked their dragging lines. They walked back toward the edge of the lumberyard, where more logs waited.
Gaz, a voice called.
A tall, yellow and black-haired soldier stood at the edge of the bridge grounds, a group of miserable men huddled behind him. That was Larish, one of the soldiers who worked the duty tent. He brought new bridgemen to replace those who'd been killed. The day was bright, without a hint of clouds, and the sun was hot on Kaladin's back. Gaz hustled up to meet the new recruits, and Kaladin and the others happened to be walking in that direction to pick up a log.
What a sorry lot, Gaz said, looking over the recruits. Of course, if they weren't, they wouldn't be sent here.
That's the truth, Larish said. These 10 at the front were caught smuggling. You know what to do.
New bridgemen were constantly needed, but there were always enough bodies. Slaves were common. But so were thieves or other lawbreakers from among the camp followers. Never Parshmen. They were too valuable. And besides, the Parshendi were some kind of cousins to the Parshmen. Better not to give the Parshmen workers in camp the sight of their own kind fighting. Sometimes a soldier would be thrown into a bridge crew. That only happened if he'd done something extremely bad, like striking an officer. Acts that would earn a hanging in many armies meant being sent to the bridge crews here. Supposedly, survive 100 bridge runs, you'd be released. It had happened once or twice, the stories said. It was probably just a myth, intended to give the bridgemen some tiny hope for survival. Kaladin and the others walked past the newcomers, gazes down, and began hooking their ropes to the next log.
Bridge 4 needs some men, Gaz said, rubbing his chin.
4 always needs men, Larish said. Don't worry, I brought you a special batch for it.
He nodded toward a second group of recruits, much more ragtag, walking up behind. Kaladin slowly stood upright. One of the prisoners in that group was a boy of merely 14 or 15. Short, spindly, with a round face.
Tien?
He whispered, taking a step forward. He stopped, shaking himself. Tien was dead. But this newcomer looked so familiar with those frightened black eyes. It made Kaladin want to shelter the boy, protect him.
But he'd failed.
Everyone he'd tried to protect, from Tien to Sen, had ended up dead. What was the point? He turned back to dragging the log.
Kaladin, Syl said, landing on the log. I'm going to leave.
He blinked in shock.
Syl, leave? But
she was the last thing he had left.
No,
he whispered. It came out as a croak.
I'll try to come back, she said. But I don't know what will happen when I leave you. Things are strange. I have odd memories. No, most of them aren't even memories. Instincts. One of those tells me that if I leave you, I might lose myself.
Then don't go, he said, growing terrified.
I have to, she said, cringing. I can't watch this anymore. I'll try to return.
She looked sorrowful.
Goodbye.
And with that, she zipped away into the air, adopting the form of a tiny group of tumbling, translucent leaves. Kaladin watched her go, numb. Then he turned back to hauling the log. What else could he do? The youth, the one that reminded him of Tien, died during the very next bridge run. It was a bad one. The Parshendi were in position, waiting for Satius. Kaladin charged the chasm, not even flinching as men were slaughtered around him. It wasn't bravery that drove him. It wasn't even a wish that those arrows would take him and end it all. He ran. That was what he did. Like a boulder rolled down a hill, or like rain fell from the sky. They didn't have a choice. Neither did he. He wasn't a man. He was a thing. And things just did what they did. The bridgemen laid their bridges in a tight line. 4 crews had fallen. Kaladin's own team had lost nearly enough to stop them. Bridge placed, Kaladin turned away, the army charging across the wood to start the real battle. He stumbled back across the plateau. After a few moments, he found what he was looking for. The boy's body. Kaladin stood, wind whipping at his hair, looking down at the corpse. It lay face up in a small hollow in the stone. Kaladin remembered lying in a similar hollow, holding a similar corpse. Another bridgeman had fallen nearby, bristling with arrows. It was the man who'd lived through Kaladin's first bridge run all those weeks back. His body slumped to the side, lying on a stone outcropping a foot or so above the corpse of the boy. Blood dripped from the tip of an arrow sticking out his back. It fell, one ruby drop at a time, splattering on the boy's open, lifeless eye. A little trail of red ran from the eye down the side of his face, like crimson tears. That night, Kaladin huddled in the barrack, listening to a high storm buffet the wall. He curled against the cold stone. Thunder shattered the sky outside.
I can't keep going like this, he thought. I'm dead inside as sure as if I'd taken a spear through the neck.
The storm continued its tirade. And for the first time in a year, Kaladin found himself crying. 10. Stories of Surgeons. 9 years ago. Cal stumbled into the surgery room, the open door letting in bright white sunlight. At 10 years old, he was already showing signs that he would be tall and lanky. He'd always preferred Cal to his full name, Kaladin. The shorter name made him fit in better. Kaladin sounded like a light-eyes name. "I'm sorry, Father," he said. Cal's father, Liren, carefully tightened the strap around the arm of the young woman who was tied onto the narrow operating table. Her eyes were closed. Cal had missed the administration of the drug. "We will discuss your tardiness later," Liren said, securing the woman's other hand. "Close the door." Cal cringed and closed the door. The windows were dark, shutters firmly in place, and so the only light was that of the stormlight shining from a large globe filled with spheres. Each of those spheres was a brome, in total an incredible sum, that was on permanent loan from Hearthstone's landlord. Lanterns flickered, but stormlight was always true. That could save lives, Cal's father said. Cal approached the table anxious. The young woman, Sani, had sleek black hair, not tinged with even a single strand of brown or blonde. She was 15, and her free hand was wrapped with a bloody, ragged bandage. Cal grimaced at the clumsy bandaging job. It looked like the cloth had been ripped from someone's shirt and tied in haste. Sani's head rolled to the side and she mumbled, drugged. She wore only a white cotton shift, her safe hand exposed. Older boys in the town sniggered about the chances they'd had, or claimed to have had, at seeing girls in their shifts, but Cal didn't understand what the excitement was all about. He was worried about Sani, though. He always worried when someone was wounded. Fortunately, the wound didn't look terrible. If it had been life-threatening, his father would have already begun working on it, using Cal's mother, Hesina, as an assistant. Liren walked to the side of the room and gathered up a few small, clear bottles. He was a short man, balding despite his relative youth. He wore his spectacles, which he called the most precious gift he'd ever been given. He rarely got them out except for surgery, as they were too valuable to risk just wearing about. What if they were scratched or broken? Hearthstone was a large town, but its remote location in northern Alethkar would make replacing the spectacles difficult. The room was kept neat, the shelves and table washed clean each morning, everything in its place. Liren said you could tell a lot about a man from how he kept his workspace. Was it sloppy or orderly? Did he respect his tools, or did he leave them casually about? The town's only fabrial clock sat here on the counter. The small device bore a single dial at the center and a glowing smokestone at its heart. It had to be infused to keep the time. Nobody else in the town cared about minutes and hours as Liren did. Cal pulled over a stool to get a better vantage. Soon he wouldn't need the stool. He was growing taller by the day. He inspected Sani's hand. "She'll be all right," he told himself, as his father had trained him. "A surgeon needs to be calm. Worry just wastes time." It was hard advice to follow. "Hands," Liren said, not turning away from gathering his tools. Cal sighed, hopping off his stool and hurrying over to the basin of warm, soapy water by the door. "Why does it matter?" He wanted to be at work, helping Sani. "Wisdom of the heralds," Liren said absently, repeating a lecture he'd given many times before. "Deathspren and Rotspren hate water. It will keep them away." "Hammy says that's silly," Cal said. "He says Deathspren are mighty good at killing folk, so why should they be afraid of a little water?" "The heralds were wise beyond our understanding," Cal grimaced. "But they're demons, father." I heard it off that Ardent who came teaching last spring.
That's the Radiance he spoke of, Liren said sharply. You're mixing them again.
Cal sighed.
The Heralds were sent to teach mankind, Liren said. They led us against the Voidbringers after we were cast from heaven. The Radiants were the orders of knights they founded, who were demons.
Who betrayed us, Liren said, once the Heralds left.
Liren raised a finger. They were not demons. They were just men who had too much power and not enough sense. Either way, you are always to wash your hands. You can see the effect it has on Rotspren with your own eyes, even if Deathspren cannot be seen.
Cal sighed again, but did as he was told.
Liren walked over to the table again, bearing a tray lined with knives and little glass bottles. His ways were odd. Though Liren made certain that his son didn't mix up the Heralds and the Lost Radiance, Cal had heard his father say that he thought the Voidbringers weren't real. Ridiculous. Who else could be blamed when things went missing in the night, or when a crop got infected with digger worms? The others in town thought Liren spent too much time with books and sick people, and that made him strange. They were uncomfortable around him, and with Cal by association. Cal was only just beginning to realize how painful it could feel to be different. Hands washed, he hopped back up onto the stool. He began to feel nervous again, hoping that nothing would go wrong. His father used a mirror to focus the sphere's light onto Sani's hand. Gingerly, he cut off the makeshift bandage with a surgeon's knife. The wound wasn't life-threatening, but the hand was pretty badly mangled. When his father had started training Cal 2 years before, sights like this had sickened him. Now he was used to torn flesh. That was good. Cal figured this would be useful when he went to war someday, to fight for his High Prince and the Light Eyes. Sani had 3 broken fingers, and the skin over her hand was scraped and gouged, the wound cluttered with sticks and dirt. The 3rd finger was the worst, shattered and twisted nastily, splinters of bone protruding through the skin. Cal felt its length, noting the fractured bones, the blackness on the skin. He carefully wiped away dried blood and dirt with a wet cloth, picking out rocks and sticks as his father cut thread for sewing. The 3rd finger will have to go, won't it? Cal said, tying a bandage around the base of the finger to keep it from bleeding. His father nodded, a hint of a smile on his face. He'd hoped Cal would discern that. Liren often said that a wise surgeon must know what to remove and what to save. If that 3rd finger had been set properly at first, but no, it was beyond recovery. Sewing it back together would mean leaving it to fester and die. His father did the actual amputation. He had such careful, precise hands. Training as a surgeon took over 10 years, and it would be some time yet before Liren let Cal hold the knife. Instead, Cal wiped away blood, handed his father knives, and held the sinew to keep it from tangling as his father sewed. They repaired the hand, so far as they could, working with deliberate speed. Cal's father finished the final suture, obviously pleased at having been able to save 4 of the fingers. That wasn't how Sani's parents would see it. They'd be disappointed that their beautiful daughter would now have a disfigured hand. It almost always happened that way. Terror at the initial wound, then anger at Liren's inability to work wonders. Liren said it was because the townsfolk had grown accustomed to having a surgeon. To them, the healing had become an expectation, rather than a privilege. But Sani's parents were good people. They'd make a small donation, and Cal's family, his parents, him, and his younger brother Tien, would continue to be able to eat. Odd how they survived because of others' misfortune. Maybe that was part of what made the townsfolk resent them. Lirin finished by using a small heated rod to cauterize where he felt the stitches wouldn't be enough. Finally, he spread pungent Lister's oil across the hand to prevent infection. The oil frightened away rot spren even better than soap and water. Cal wrapped on clean bandages, careful not to disturb the splints. Lirin disposed of the finger, and Cal began to relax. She'd be all right.
"You still need to work on those nerves of yours, son," Lirin said softly, washing blood from his hands.
Cal looked down.
"It is good to care," Lirin said. "But caring, like anything else, can be a problem if it interferes with your ability to perform surgery."
"Caring too much can be a problem?" Cal thought back at his father. "And what about being so selfless that you never charge for your work?" He didn't dare say the words. Cleaning the room came next. It seemed like half of Cal's life was spent cleaning, but Lirin wouldn't let him go until they were done with it. At least he opened the shutters, letting sunlight stream in. Sani continued to doze. The winter wart would keep her unconscious for hours yet.
"So, where were you?"
Lirin asked, bottles of oil and alcohol clinking as he returned them to their places.
"With Jam."
"Jam is 2 years your senior," Lirin said. "I doubt he has much fondness for spending his time with those much younger than he."
"His father started training him in the quarterstaff," Cal said in a rush. "Tien and I went to see what he's learned."
Cal cringed, waiting for the lecture. His father just continued, wiping down each of his surgeon's knives with alcohol, then oil, as the old traditions dictated. He didn't turn toward Cal.
"Jam's father was a soldier in Bright Lord Amaram's army," Cal said tentatively.
Bright Lord Amaram, the noble light-eyed general who watched over northern Alethkar. Cal wanted so much to see a real light eyes, not stuffy old Wistio. A soldier, like everyone talked about, like the stories were about.
"I know about Jam's father," Lirin said. "I've had to operate on that lame leg of his 3 times now. A gift of his glorious time as a soldier."
"We need soldiers, father. You'd have our borders violated by the Thalans?"
"Thalanna is an island kingdom," Lirin said calmly. "They don't share a border with us."
"Well, then, they could attack us from sea."
"They're mostly tradesmen and merchants. Everyone I've met has tried to swindle me, but that's hardly the same thing as invading. All the boys like to tell stories about far-off places." It was hard to remember that Cal's father, the only man of second none in the town, had traveled all the way to Carbranth during his youth.
"Well, we fight with someone," Cal continued, moving to scrub the floor.
"Yes," his father said after a pause. "King Gavilar always finds people for us to fight. That much is true."
"So we need soldiers, like I said."
"We need surgeons more," Lirin sighed audibly, turning away from his cabinet. "Son, you nearly cry each time someone is brought to us. You grind your teeth anxiously during even simple procedures. What makes you think you could actually hurt someone?"
"I'll get stronger."
"That's foolishness. Who's put these ideas in your head? Why would you want to learn to hit other boys with a stick?"
"For honor, father," Cal said.
"Who tells stories about surgeons for the Herald's sake?" "The children of the men and women whose lives we save," Lirin said evenly, meeting Cal's gaze. "That's who tells stories of surgeons." Cal blushed and shrank back, then finally returned to his scrubbing. "There are 2 kinds of people in this world, son," his father said sternly. "Those who save lives, and those who take lives."
"And what of those who protect and defend? The ones who save lives by taking lives,"
his father snorted. "That's like trying to stop a storm by blowing harder,"
Ridiculous. You can't protect by killing.
Cal kept scrubbing. Finally, his father sighed, walking over and kneeling down beside him, helping with the scrubbing.
What are the properties of winterwort?
Bitter taste, Cal said immediately, which makes it safer to keep since people won't eat it by accident. Crush it to powder, mix it with oil, use one spoonful per 10 brick weight of the person you're drugging. Induces a deep sleep for about 5 hours.
And how can you tell if someone has the fiddle pox?
Nervous energy, Cal said. Thirst, trouble sleeping, and swelling on the undersides of the arms.
You've got such a good mind, son, Liren said softly. It took me years to learn what you've done in months. I've been saving. I'd like to send you to Carbranth when you turn 16, to train with real surgeons.
Cal felt a spike of excitement. Carbranth? That was in an entirely different kingdom. Cal's father had traveled there as a courier, but he hadn't trained there as a surgeon. He'd learned from Old Vaith in Shorsbrun, the nearest town of any size.
You have a gift from the heralds themselves, Liren said, resting a hand on Cal's shoulder.
You could be 10 times the surgeon I am. Don't dream the small dreams of other men. Our grandfathers bought and worked us to the second non so that we could have full citizenship and the right of travel. Don't waste that on killing.
Cal hesitated, but soon found himself nodding. 11. Droplets.
3 of 16 ruled, but now the Broken One reigns.
Collected, Chachanan, 1173, 84 seconds pre-death. Subject, a cut purse with the wasting sickness, of partial Iriale descent. The high storm eventually subsided. It was the dusk of the day the boy had died, the day Syl had left him. Kaladin slid on his sandals, the same ones he'd taken from the leathery-faced man on that first day, and stood up. He walked through the crowded barrack. There were no beds, just one thin blanket for bridgemen. One had to choose whether to use it for cushioning or warmth. You could freeze, or you could ache. Those were bridgemen's options, though several of the bridgemen had found a third use for the blankets. They wrapped them around their heads, as if to block out sight, sound, and smell. To hide from the world. The world would find them anyway. It was good at these kinds of games. Rain fell in sheets outside, the wind still stiff. Flashes lit the western horizon, where the center of the storm flew onward. This was an hour or so before the riddens, and was as early as one would want to go out in a high storm. Well, one never wanted to go out in a high storm, but this was about as early as it was safe to go out. The lightning had passed. The winds were manageable. He passed through the dim lumber yard, hunched against the wind. Branches lay scattered about like bones in a white spine's lair. Leaves were plastered by rainwater to the rough sides of barracks. Kaladin splashed through puddles that chilled and numbed his feet. That felt good. They were still sore from the bridge run earlier. Waves of icy rain blew across him, wetting his hair, dripping down his face and into his scruffy beard. He hated having a beard, particularly the way the whiskers itched at the corners of his mouth. Beards were like axe-hound pups. Boys dreamed of the day they'd get one, never realizing how annoying they could be.
"Out for a stroll, your lordship?" a voice said.
Kaladin looked up to find Gaz huddled in a nearby hollow between two of the barracks. Why was he out in the rain? Ah. Gaz had fastened a small metal basket on the leeward side of one of the barracks, and a soft, glowing light came from within. He left his spheres out in the storm, then had come out early to retrieve them. It was a risk. Even a sheltered basket could get torn free.
Some people believed that the shades of the Lost Radiance haunted the storms, stealing spheres. Perhaps that was true. But during his time in the army, Kaladin had known more than one man who had been wounded sneaking around during full storm looking for spheres. No doubt the superstition was due to more worldly thieves. There were safer ways to infuse spheres. Money changers would exchange done spheres for infused ones, or you could pay them to infuse yours in one of their safely guarded nests.
"What are you doing?" Gaz demanded.
The short, one-eyed man clutched the basket to his chest.
"I'll have you strung up if you've stolen anyone's spheres."
Kaladin turned away from him.
"Storm you, I'll have you strung up anyway. Don't think you can run away. There are still sentries. You..."
"I'm going to the Honor Chasm," Kaladin said quietly. His voice would barely be audible over the storm. Gaz shut up. The Honor Chasm. He lowered his metal basket and made no further objections. There was a certain deference given to men who took that road. Kaladin continued to cross the courtyard.
"Lordling," Gaz called.
Kaladin turned.
"Leave the sandals and vest," Gaz said. "I don't want to have to send someone down to fetch them."
Kaladin pulled the leather vest over his head and dropped it to the ground with a splash, then left the sandals in a puddle. That left him in a dirty shirt and stiff brown trousers, both taken off a dead man. Kaladin walked through the storm to the east side of the lumberyard. A low thundering rumbled from the west. The pathway down to the shattered plains was familiar to him now. He'd run this way a dozen times with the bridge crews. There wasn't a battle every day, perhaps one in every two or three. And not every bridge crew had to go on every run. But many of the runs were so draining, so horrific, that they left the bridgemen stunned, almost unresponsive, for the days between. Many bridgemen had trouble making decisions. The same happened to men who were shocked by battle. Kaladin felt those effects in himself. Even deciding to come to the chasm had been difficult. But the bleeding eyes of that unnamed boy haunted him. He wouldn't make himself go through something like that again. He couldn't. He reached the base of the slope, wind-driven rain pelting his face as if trying to shove him back toward the camp. He kept on, walking up to the nearest chasm. The Honor Chasm, the bridgemen called it, for it was the place where they could make the one decision left to them. The honorable decision. Death. They weren't natural, these chasms. This one started narrow, but as it ran toward the east, it grew wider and deeper, incredibly quickly. At only 10 feet long, the crack was already wide enough that it would be difficult to jump. A group of 6 rope ladders with wooden rungs hung here, affixed to spikes in the rock, used by bridgemen sent down to salvage from corpses that had fallen into the chasms during bridge runs. Kaladin looked out over the plains. He couldn't see much through the darkness and rain. No, this place wasn't natural. The land had been broken, and now it broke the people who came to it. Kaladin walked past the ladders, a little farther along the edge of the chasm. Then he sat down, legs over the side, looking down as the rain fell around him, the droplets plunging into the dark depths. To his sides, the more adventurous kremlings had left their lairs, scuttling about, feeding on plants that lapped up the rainwater. Lirin had once explained that high storm rains were rich with nutrients. Storm wardens in Kolinar and Vaidenar had proven that plants given storm water did better than those given lake or river water. Why was it that scientists were so excited to discover facts that farmers had known for generations and generations? Kaladin watched the drops of water streaking down toward oblivion in the crevasse. Little suicidal jumpers. Thousands upon thousands of them. Millions upon millions. Who knew what awaited them in that darkness? You couldn't see it, couldn't know it, until you joined them. leaping off into the void and letting the wind bear you down.
You were right, Father, Kaladin whispered. You can't stop a storm by blowing harder. You can't save men by killing others. We should all become surgeons. Every last one of us.
He was rambling, but oddly his mind felt clearer now than it had in weeks. Perhaps it was the clarity of perspective. Most men spent their entire lives wondering about the future. Well, his future was empty now. So he turned backward, thinking about his father, about Tien, about decisions. Once his life had seemed simple. That was before he'd lost his brother, before he'd been betrayed in Amaram's army. Would Kaladin go back to those innocent days if he could? Would he prefer to pretend everything was simple? No. He'd had no easy fall like those drops. He'd earned his scars. He'd bounced off walls, bashed his face in hands. He'd killed innocent men by accident. He'd walked beside those with hearts like blackened coals, adoring them. He'd scrambled and climbed and fallen and stumbled. And now here he was, at the end of it all. Understanding so much more, but somehow feeling no wiser. He climbed to his feet on the lip of that chasm, and could feel his father's disappointment looming over him, like the thunderheads above. He put one foot out over the void.
Kaladin!
He froze at the soft but piercing voice. A translucent form bobbed in the air, approaching through the weakening rain. The figure lunged forward, then sank, then surged higher again, like it was bearing something heavy. Kaladin brought his foot back and held out his hand. Syl unceremoniously alighted upon it, shaped like a sky eel clutching something dark in its mouth. She switched to the familiar form of a young woman, dress fluttering around her legs. She held in her hands a narrow, dark green leaf with a point divided in three. Blackbane.
What is this? Kaladin asked.
She looked exhausted.
These things are heavy.
She lifted the leaf.
I brought it for you.
He took the leaf between his two fingers. Blackbane. Poison.
Why did you bring this to me? He said harshly.
I thought,
Syl said, shying back.
Well, you kept those other leaves so carefully. Then you lost them when you tried to help that man in the slave cages. I thought it would make you happy to have another one.
Kaladin almost laughed. She had no concept of what she'd done, fetching him a leaf of one of Roshar's most deadly natural poisons because she'd wanted to make him happy. It was ridiculous. And sweet.
Everything seemed to go wrong when you lost that leaf,
Syl said in a soft voice.
Before that, you fought.
I failed.
She cowered down, kneeling on his palm, misty skirt around her legs, drops of rainwater passing through her and rippling her form.
You don't like it, then? I flew so far, I almost forgot myself. But I came back. I came back, Kaladin.
Why? He pled. Why do you care?
Because I do, she said, cocking her head. I watched you, you know, back in that army. You'd always find the young, untrained men and protect them, even though it put you into danger. I can remember. Just barely, but I do.
I failed them. They're dead now.
They would have died more quickly without you. You made it so they had a family in the army. I remember their gratitude. It's what drew me in the first place. You helped them.
No,
he said, clutching the blackbane in his fingers.
Everything I touch withers and dies.
He teetered on the ledge. Thunder rumbled in the distance.
Those men in the bridge crew?
Syl whispered.
You could help them.
Too late.
He closed his eyes, thinking of the dead boy earlier in the day.
It's too late. I failed. They're dead. They're all going to die, and there's no way out.
What is one more try, then? Her voice was soft, yet somehow stronger than the storm. What could it hurt? He paused. You can't fail this time, Kaladin. You've said it. They're all going to die anyway.
He thought of Tien and his dead eyes staring upward.
I don't know what you mean most of the time when you speak, she said. My mind is so cloudy. But it seems that if you're worried about hurting people, you shouldn't be afraid to help the bridge men. What more could you do to them?
I...
One more try, Kaladin, she whispered. Please?
One more try. The men huddled in the barrack with barely a blanket to call their own. Frightened of the storm. Frightened of each other. Frightened of what the next day would bring. One more try. He thought of himself. Crying at the death of a boy he hadn't known. A boy he hadn't even tried to help. One more try. Kaladin opened his eyes. He was cold and wet, but he felt a tiny, warm candle flame of determination come alight inside him. He clenched his hand, crushing the blackbane leaf inside, then dropped it over the side of the chasm. He lowered the other hand, which was still holding Syl. She zipped up into the air, anxious.
Kaladin?
He stalked away from the chasm, bare feet splashing in puddles and stepping heedlessly on rockbud vines. The incline he'd come down was covered with flat, slate-like plants that had opened like books to the rain, ruffled lacy red and green leaves connecting the two halves. Lifespren, little green blips of light, brighter than Syl but small as spores, danced among the plants, dodging raindrops. Kaladin strode up, water streaming past him in tiny rivers. At the top, he returned to the bridge yard. It was still empty, save for Gaz, who was tying a ripped tarp back into place. Kaladin had crossed most of the distance to the man before Gaz noticed him. The wiry sergeant scowled.
Too cowardly to go through with it, your lordship? Well, if you think I'm giving back...
He cut off with a gagging noise as Kaladin lunged forward, grabbing Gaz by the neck. Gaz lifted an arm in surprise, but Kaladin batted it away and swept the man's legs out from under him, slamming him down to the rocky ground, throwing up a splash of water. Gaz's eyes opened wide with shock and pain, and he began to strangle under the pressure of Kaladin's grip on his throat.
The world just changed, Gaz, Kaladin said, leaning in close. I died down at that chasm. Now you've got my vengeful spirit to deal with.
Squirming, Gaz looked about frantically for help that wasn't there. Kaladin didn't have trouble holding him down. There was one thing about running bridges. If you survived long enough, it built up the muscles. Kaladin let up slightly on Gaz's neck, allowing him a gasping breath. Then Kaladin leaned down further. We're going to start over new, you and I. Clean. And I want you to understand something from the start. I'm already dead. You can't hurt me. Understand? Gaz nodded slowly, and Kaladin gave him another breath of frigid, humid air. Bridge 4 is mine, Kaladin said. You can assign us tasks, but I'm bridge leader. The other one died today, so you have to pick a new leader anyway. Understand? Gaz nodded again. You learn quickly, Kaladin said, letting the man breathe freely. He stepped back, and Gaz hesitantly got to his feet. There was hatred in his eyes, but it was veiled. He seemed worried about something. Something more than Kaladin's threats. I want to stop paying down my slave debt, Kaladin said. How much do bridgemen make?
2 clear marks a day, Gaz said,
scowling at him and rubbing his neck. So a slave would make half that. One diamond mark. A pittance. But Kaladin would need it. He'd also need to keep Gaz in line. I'll start taking my wages, Kaladin said. But you get to keep one mark in five. Gaz started, glancing at him in the dim, overcast light. For your efforts, Kaladin said.
For what efforts?
Kaladin stepped up to him.
Your efforts in staying the damnation out of my way. Understood?
Gaz nodded again. Kaladin walked away. He hated to waste money on a bribe, but Gaz needed a consistent, repetitive reminder of why he should avoid getting Kaladin killed. One mark every 5 days wasn't much of a reminder, but for a man who was willing to risk going out in the middle of a high storm to protect his spheres, it might be enough. Kaladin walked back to Bridge Four's small barrack, pulling open the thick wooden door. The men huddled inside just as he'd left them. But something had changed. Had they always looked that pathetic? Yes, they had. Kaladin was the one who had changed, not they. He felt a strange dislocation, as if he'd allowed himself to forget, if only in part, the last 9 months. He reached back across time, studying the man he had been, the man who'd still fought and fought well. He couldn't be that man again. He couldn't erase the scars. But he could learn from that man, as a new squad leader learned from the victorious generals of the past. Kaladin Stormblessed was dead, but Kaladin Bridgeman was of the same blood. A descendant with potential. Kaladin walked to the first huddled figure. The man wasn't sleeping. Who could sleep through a high storm? The man cringed as Kaladin knelt beside him. "What's your name?" Kaladin asked, Syl flitting down and studying the man's face. He wouldn't be able to see her. The man was older, with drooping cheeks, brown eyes, and close-cropped, white-salted hair. His beard was short, and he didn't have a slave mark. "Your name?" Kaladin repeated firmly. "Stormoff," the man said, rolling over. Kaladin hesitated, then leaned in, speaking in a low voice. "Look, friend, you can either tell me your name, or I'll keep pestering you. Continue refusing, and I'll tow you out into that storm and hang you over the chasm by one leg until you tell me." The man glanced back over his shoulder. Kaladin nodded slowly, holding the man's gaze. "Teft," the man said finally. "My name's Teft." "That wasn't so hard," Kaladin said, holding out his hand.
"I'm Kaladin, your bridge leader."
The man hesitated, then took Kaladin's hand, wrinkling his brow in confusion. Kaladin vaguely remembered the man. He'd been in the crew for a while, a few weeks at least. Before that, he'd been on another bridge crew. One of the punishments for bridgemen who committed camp infractions was a transfer to Bridge Four. "Get some rest," Kaladin said, releasing Teft's hand. "We're going to have a hard day tomorrow."
"How do you know?"
Teft asked, rubbing his bearded chin.
"Because we're bridgemen," Kaladin said, standing. "Every day is hard."
Teft hesitated, then smiled faintly.
"Collect knows that's true."
Kaladin left him, moving down the line of huddled figures. He visited each man, prodding or threatening until the man gave his name. They each resisted. It was as if their names were the last things they owned, and wouldn't be given up cheaply, though they seemed surprised, perhaps even encouraged, that someone cared to ask. He clutched to these names, repeating each one in his head, holding them like gemstones. The names mattered. The men mattered. Perhaps Kaladin would die in the next bridge run, or perhaps he would break under the strain and give Amaram one final victory. But as he settled down on the ground to plan, he felt that tiny warmth burning steadily within him. It was the warmth of decisions made and purpose seized.
It was responsibility. Syl alighted on his leg as he sat, whispering the names of the men to himself. She looked encouraged, bright, happy. He didn't feel any of that. He felt grim, tired, and wet. But he wrapped himself in the responsibility he had taken, the responsibility for these men. He held to it like a climber clung to his last handhold as he dangled from a cliffside. He would find a way to protect them. The end of part one. Interludes. Ishik, Nanbalat, Zeth. I-1. Ishik. Ishik splashed toward the meeting with the strange foreigners, whistling softly to himself, his pole with buckets on each end resting on his shoulders. He wore lake sandals on his submerged feet and a pair of knee-length breeches. No shirt. New relic forbid. A good Pure Laker never covered his shoulders when the sun was shining. A man could get sick that way, not getting enough sunlight. He whistled, but not because he was having a pleasant day. In point of fact, the day New Ralik had provided was close to horrible. Only 5 fish swam in Ishik's buckets, and 4 were of the dullest, most common variety. The tides had been irregular, as if the Pure Lake itself was in a foul mood. Bad days were coming, sure as the sun and the tide they were. The Pure Lake extended in all directions, hundreds of miles wide, its glassy surface perfectly transparent. At its deepest, it was never more than 6 feet from shimmering surface to the bottom. And in most places, the warm, slow-moving water came up only to about mid-calf. It was filled with tiny fish, colorful kremlings, and eel-like river spren. The Pure Lake was life itself. Once this land had been claimed by a king. Sela Tales, the nation had been called, one of the epic kingdoms. Well, they could name it what they wanted, but New Ralik knew that the boundaries of nature were far more important than the boundaries of nations. Ishik was a Pure Laker. First and foremost, by tide and sun he was. He walked confidently through the water, though the footing could sometimes be precarious. The pleasantly warm water lapped at his legs just below the knees, and he made very few splashes. He knew to move slowly, careful not to put his weight down before he was sure he wasn't stepping on a spike main or a sharp lip of rock. Ahead, the village of Fuabra broke the glassy perfection, a cluster of buildings perched on blocks beneath the water. Their domed roofs made them look like the rock buds that sprouted from the ground, and they were the only things for miles around that broke the surface of the Pure Lake. Other people walked about here, moving with the same slow gait. It was possible to run through the water, but there was rarely a reason. What could be so important that you had to go and make a splash and ruckus getting to it? Ishik shook his head at that. Only foreigners were so hasty. He nodded to Thaspik, a dark-skinned man who passed him pulling a small raft. It was stacked with a few piles of cloth. He'd probably taken them out for washing.
"Ho, Ishik," the scrawny man said. "How's fishing?"
"Terrible," he called. "Boon Macaque has blighted me right good today. And you?"
"Lost his shirt while washing,"
Thaspik replied, his voice pleasant.
"Ah, that's the way of things. Are my foreigners here?"
"Sure are. Over at Mabe's place."
"Vun McCock said they don't eat her out of home," Ishik said, continuing on his way. "Or infect her with their constant worries."
"Sun and tide send it,"
Thaspik said with a chuckle, continuing on. Mabe's house was near the center of the village. Ishik wasn't sure what made her want to live inside the building. Most nights he did just fine sleeping on his raft. It never got cold in the Pure Lake, except during high storms, and you could last through those right well, New Ralik sent the way.
The Pure Lake drained into pits and holes when the storms came, and so you just shoved your raft into a crevice between two ridges of stone and huddled up next to it, using it to break the fury of the tempest. The storms weren't so bad out here as they were in the east, where they flung boulders and blew down buildings. Oh, he'd heard stories about that sort of life. New relics and he never had to go to such a terrible place. Besides, it was probably cold there. Ishik pitied those who had to live in the cold. Why didn't they just come to the Pure Lake? New relics and that they don't, he thought, walking up to Mabe's place. If everyone knew how nice the Pure Lake was, surely they'd all want to live here, and there wouldn't be a place to walk without stumbling over some foreigner. He stepped up into the building, exposing his calves to the air. The floor was low enough that a few inches of water still covered it. Pure Lakers liked it that way. It was natural, though if the tide dropped, sometimes buildings would drain. Minnows shot out around his toes. Common types, not worth anything. Maeve stood inside, fixing a pot of fish soup, and she nodded to him. She was a stout woman, and had been chasing Ishik for years, trying to bait him to wed her on account of her fine cooking. He just might let her catch him some day. His foreigners were in the corner, at a table only they would choose. The one that was raised up an extra bit, with footrests so that the outsiders wouldn't have to get their toes wet. New relic, what fools, he thought with amusement. Inside out of the sun, wearing shirts against its warmth, feet out of the tide, no wonder their thoughts are so odd. He set his buckets down, nodding to Mabe. She eyed him. Good fishing? Terrible. Ah, well, your soup is free today, Ishik, to make up for Vun Makak's cursing. Thanks much kindly, he said, taking a steaming bowl from her. She smiled. Now he owed her. Enough bowls, and he'd be forced to wet her. There's a coal grill in the bucket for you, he noted. Caught it early this morning. Her stout face grew uncertain. A coal grill was a very lucky fish. Cured aching joints for a good month after you ate it, and sometimes let you see when friends were going to visit by letting you read the shapes of the clouds. Mabe had quite a fondness for them, on account of the finger aches New Relic had sent her. One coal grill would be 2 weeks of soup, and would put her in debt to him. Vun Makak, are you? She muttered in annoyance, walking over to check. That one's all right. How am I ever going to catch you, man? I'm a fisher, Mabe, he said, taking a slurp of his soup. The bowl was shaped for easy slurping. Hard to catch a fisher. You know that. He chuckled to himself, walking up to his foreigners as she plucked out the coal grill. There were three of them. Two were dark-skinned Makabaki, though they were the strangest Makabaki he'd ever seen. One was thick-limbed, where most of his kind were small and fine-boned, and he had a completely bald head. The other was taller, with short dark hair, lean muscles, and broad shoulders. In his head, Ishik called them Grump and Blunt, on account of their personalities. The third man had light tan skin, like an Alethi. He didn't seem quite right either, though. The eyes were the wrong shape, and his accent was certainly not Alethi. He spoke the Salai language worse than the other two, and usually stayed quiet. He seemed thoughtful, though. Ishik called him Thinker. Wonder how he earned that scar across his scalp, Ishik thought. Life outside the Pure Lake was very dangerous. Lots of wars, particularly to the east.
You are late, traveler, said tall, stiff Blunt.
He had the build and air of a soldier, though none of the three carried weapons. Ishik frowned, sitting and reluctantly putting his feet out of the water.
Isn't it Warley Day?
The day is right, friend, Grump said. But we were to meet at noon. Understand?
He generally did most of the talking.
We're close to that, Ishik said. Honestly, who paid attention to what hour it was? Foreigners. Always so busy.
Grump just shook his head as Mabe brought them some soup. Her place was the closest thing the village had to an inn. She left Ishik a soft cloth napkin and a nice cup of sweet wine, trying to balance that fish as quickly as possible.
Very well, Grump said. Let us have your report, friend. I've been to Fu Rallis, Fu Namir, Fu Albast, and Fu Morin this month, Ishik said, taking a slurp of soup. Nobody has seen this man you search for. You asked the right questions, Blunt said. You are certain? Of course I'm certain, Ishik said. I have been doing this for ages now. 5 months, Blunt corrected. And no results. Ishik shrugged. You wish me to make up stories? Vun Macaque would like me to do that. No, no stories, friend, Grump said. We want only the truth. Well, I've given it to you. You swear by New Relic, that god of yours?
Hush, Ishik said. Don't say his name. Are you idiots?
Grump frowned.
But he is your god. Understand? Is his name holy? Never to be spoken?
Foreigners were so stupid. Of course New Relic was their god. But you always pretended that he wasn't. Vun Macaque, his younger, spiteful brother, had to be tricked into thinking you worshipped him. Otherwise he'd get jealous. It was only safe to speak of these things in a holy grotto.
I swear by Vun Macaque, Ishik said pointedly. May he watch over me and curse me as he pleases. I have looked diligently. No foreigner like this one you mention, with his white hair, clever tongue, and arrow-like face, has been seen.